Women, Slaves, and the Gender Debate, A Complementarian Response to the Redemptive Movement Hermeneutic, by Benjamin Rayock, PNR 2012, 224 pages. A brief book summary from Books at a Glance. About the author. Dr. Benjamin Rayock is pastor of Three Rivers Grace Church in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. He is a graduate of Wheaton College with advanced degrees from Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. Overview. Providing a combination of exegetical study and hermeneutical analysis, Benjamin Rayock surveys and critiques redemptive movement claims regarding gender. Specifically, Rayock critiques the claim that, despite superficial evidence to the contrary, the trajectory of New Testament teaching runs against the complementarian view of male headship. Table of Contents. Introduction. Chapter 1. The Redemptive Movement Hermeneutic. Chapter 2. New Testament Statements Concerning Slavery. Chapter 3. New Testament Statements Concerning Women. Chapter 4. Comparing the Data. Chapter 5. Hermeneutical Considerations Part 1. Chapter 6. Hermeneutical Considerations Part 2. Conclusion. Summary. Introduction. Benjamin Rayock lays out the state of affairs in wider gender discussions within theology. Egalitarians argue against the gender role distinctions which complementarians see as essential and biblical for men and women. Egalitarians use many different arguments, but one that is gaining steam is the so-called redemptive movement or trajectory hermeneutic. This approach works off of an analogy. It maintains that flying in the face of anti-abolitionists of past generations are fundamental principles, even an ultimate ethic, in the Bible which definitively point away from slavery. The abolition of slavery on moral grounds is the Bible's trajectory, even if it never explicitly comes out and says as much. Many can agree with that premise. Redemptive movement advocates then continue that, in the same way, the Bible's ultimate ethic cuts against male headship, even if such is not stated explicitly in the Bible. Stated differently, contrary to pro-slavery voices in the 19th century, the Bible points beyond slavery. Likewise, the Bible points beyond the distinct gender roles long thought to be God-given. This book seeks to evaluate that claim, as well as demonstrate that the trajectory approach is not viable for the complexities of the gender debate, complexities which involve much more than cultural traditions, but creation, personhood, family, and difference within the context of equality. Chapter 1. The Redemptive Movement Hermeneutic. First, we turn to summarize the history of scholarship relating the slavery debate to the roles of women in the New Testament. Christer Stendahl presents a hermeneutical model similar to the trajectory approach in a 1966 work. He sees certain breakthrough texts such as Galatians 3:28, "There is neither Jew nor Greek, there is neither slave nor free, there is neither male nor female, for you all are one in Christ Jesus," and 1 Corinthians 11:11-12, pointing beyond the specific instructions we find elsewhere in the New Testament. Indeed, pointing to something beyond the order of creation. The uncertainty of the New Testament's stance on slavery is brought to bear here as well. As even F.F. Bruce came to see in his 1982 commentary on Galatians, the norming quality of Galatians 3:28, in tandem with the brave resistance of women against social strictures, forces us to lay aside texts disqualifying women from public speech or roles in church leadership. R.T. France, Richard Longenecker, David Thompson, William Webb, Kevin Giles, and I. Howard Marshall all contribute to the trajectory hermeneutic chorus in years since Stendahl's The Bible and the Role of Women. Arguing against this approach, an approach which generally pits Galatians 3:28 against other texts while likening gender politics to slavery, Wayne Grudem, Thomas Schreiner, and Robert Yarbrough interact with redemptive movement proponents. William Webb had advanced a seed idea hermeneutic, which appropriates the way abolitionists used in Christ texts to carry social implications in their fight for freedom. Women's issues should stand up to such social uses as well as on Webb's view of the trajectory argument. Schreiner responds that Webb focuses too little on redemptive history in his approach since. For instance, he elevates the vegetarianism of Eden to the same level as gender roles in the created order. For Webb, if we discount one, we should be willing to dispense with the other, regardless of the place of certain features of creation in the rest of redemptive history. On the broader hermeneutical questions, all would do well to remember that we come to biblical texts, not to mention social issues, with presuppositions. Such preconceived ideas can and do affect our judgment, as they did for some otherwise model exegetes in the 19th century. Even Charles Hodge of Princeton Seminary was led astray on the question of slavery, as Mark Knoll's work argues. One key for interpretation, then, when looking at the relationship between abolitionist arguments and the current redemptive movement is to distinguish between general New Testament principles which many have argued cut against slavery, and specific instructions. Jesus did not condemn slavery, but this does not mean he endorses it. Jesus did not condemn every wrong he saw, referring to specific instructions, but there are larger principles at work in that regard. The Old Testament condemns man-stealing in Exodus 21:16. Abolitionists use this text as a principle to govern specific application. This task of discernment and taxonomy will be taken up in following chapters. We will look at texts concerning slaves, texts concerning women, and then compare the two in terms of hermeneutical implications. Chapter 2. New Testament Statements Concerning Slavery. In shocking contrast to what one might expect, Kevin Giles argues that there is a stronger biblical case for slavery than there is for the subordination of women. Of course, he is seeking to argue against the subordination of women just as much as to disparage slavery, but he does so in a way that must be challenged. Here we look at how the New Testament speaks to slaves and masters, including the grounds for such, why it doesn't condemn slavery altogether, and finally at the question of whether there is a biblical case for slavery. It is important to qualify discussions of slavery in the period of the New Testament. The ownership of a human being is always degrading and offensive, but first century slaves were not like those of modern Brazil or the U.S. Slaves were not assumed to be inferior. They could be well educated, they could accumulate wealth and buy their freedom, and they were not distinguishable from non-slaves by race, speech, clothing, etc. In the first century, you might enter into slavery as a youth for economic reasons with a view to being freed around age 30. Understanding the degree to which slavery truly was ingrained in the culture of the New Testament period, one need not wonder why many leaders might provide guidelines for living within it rather than lobby for its abolition. We find 5 passages in the New Testament which give instructions for how to live in a context which assumes slavery. Indeed, even slave revolts of the period only sought the freedom of the individuals involved, not the abolition of the institution. Such would only be thought an odd suggestion. Ephesians 6:5-8, Colossians 3:22-4:1, 1 Timothy 6:1, Titus 2:9-10, and 1 Peter 2:18-25 come to the fore. Each one includes an imperative addressed to slaves, douloi or oiketai, and they are exhorted to obey, to submit, or to regard their masters as worthy of honor. As Abraham Lincoln and others have noted, it is remarkable that slaves are treated as individual moral agents included in the Christian community. Significantly, the ground of the charge to obey stems from the character of their work being as unto the Lord. That is, slaves are not to work as unto men. Masters do not have ultimate rights. Indeed, the earthly relationship is downplayed. The passages in 1 Timothy and Titus show us the purpose of the slave's obedience. Christian slaves should act in such a way as to protect the reputation of Christianity. Interestingly, exhortations relative to the conduct of masters rest on the same ground. There are other texts which shed light on a disposition focusing on a holy life amidst enslavement, such as Philemon and 1 Corinthians 7:21. As to why the New Testament does not condemn slavery generally, a few points come to mind, perhaps none of them completely satisfying. 1. The way the slave system worked, with the possibility of manumission, cut against the urgent burden many might otherwise feel to abolish it. And the second point is that the church was in no position to raise the issue of abolition. Like with polygamy in earlier times, we find the toleration of a practice without either its support or condemnation. It was simply an assumed part of the social network in which men and women were called to live holy lives. Chapter 3, New Testament Statements Concerning Women. New Testament passages addressed to women can be divided into those which are supported by ground clauses and those that are supported by purpose clauses. It is important to access them in parallel to the slave passages, since the trajectory hermeneutic rests on that similarity. Three passages supported by ground clauses, 1 Corinthians 11:8, 1 Timothy 2:13, and 1 Corinthians 14:34, assume creation as the ground of exhortation to women. The burden of the redemptive movement is to show that a New Testament text addressed to women is unique in its application to that one congregation. If Paul roots his point in creation, this assumption is greatly undermined. More challenging are 1 Corinthians 14:34 and Ephesians 5:23. In 1 Corinthians 14, Paul seems to be alluding to creation when he mentions women's submission and silence. He has already mentioned women's speech in church as legitimate, so this is a more circumscribed prohibition. F.F. Bruce sees the likely background for the text in Genesis 1 and 2, where the woman is the helper of the man. Her submission in this relationship is basic to the created order. Ephesians 5:23 is unique. It treats the human relationship of marriage as a profound analogy to God's design for the church, namely, that Christ be its head. While not involving universally clear transcultural categories, Paul grounds the union of the two parties as man and wife in verse 31 by citing Genesis 2:24. There are other examples. For passages which hinge on a purpose clause, such as 1 Peter 3:1 and Colossians 3:18, nothing conclusive can be gained either for or against the redemptive movement's conclusions. And yet, quite distinct from the way New Testament authors approach slavery, seeking to minimize cultural reproach and maximize a slave's sense of heavenly citizenship, the New Testament mainly approaches women's issues as fundamental to the created order. We turn next to compare the data more thoroughly. Chapter 4. Comparing the Data. Kevin Giles' contention is that, since the New Testament endorses both slavery and male headship, we may dispense with both as social structures no longer acceptable. In contrast, we have seen that while the purpose of obedience in each case is similar, the ground for obedience is quite different. It is not the case that slavery is endorsed in the New Testament. Furthermore, to whatever extent either slavery or male headship is dealt with, the underlying rationale is different. The analogy on which the trajectory hermeneutic depends begins to crack at this point. While Giles argues that Ephesians 5 transforms the patriarchal system of marriage by likening the relationship to a Christological model of headship and self-sacrifice, he misses the fact that the Christological model is assumed to be built into creation in the marriage union of Genesis 2:24. In Paul's mind, the Christ analogy is illustrated from the beginning in the very gender relationships of male headship and wifely submission. The household codes, found in various places in the New Testament, most famously in Ephesians 5 and 6, are prime candidates in Giles' mind for selective reading by conservatives. He thinks hierarchical complementarians ignore the directives to slaves, but want to apply the directives to wives in the present day. But abolitionists and even Albert Barnes in the 19th century argued for distinctions between the two sets of commands in their opposition to slavery. Indeed, even noting the distinctions, we are forced to concede that all of the text is still applicable. Employees and employers have much to learn from the commands to slaves and slave masters, just as we wouldn't want to rule out texts commanding children to obey their parents. There are elements particular to the culture of the time in the household codes, but the texts are to be upheld and obeyed in all times. Chapter 5. Hermeneutical Considerations, Part 1. William Webb's 2001 book, Slaves, Women, and Homosexuals, presents several large-scale hermeneutical criteria for considering any given New Testament text transcultural or universal status. One major idea is Webb's concept of theological analogy. When a text bases any command in God's own character, that command will be more transcultural the more literal the analogy is. So, a command to love rooted in God's character as a lover is highly transcultural. It always and everywhere applies. But arguing for monarchy because God is king is a less sure analogy, since God is not literally a king. God is not a slave or slave master, so commands which depend on those relationships may be bound to situations where such things exist. The analogy breaks down since the reality does not find root in God's being directly. So far, so good. Webb has helped us clarify one perspective on why slavery is not endorsed in the New Testament, but what of male headship? Redemptive movement writers overly rely on texts which present analogies between the marriage relationship and a theological reality. We have seen that the majority of cases actually look back to creation. But of those texts which do rely on analogy, is Christ not literally the head of the church? The problem is that Webb, in arguing to the contrary, has let a very general and vague theory do too much work. Christ lays down his life for the church as its head as the church submits to Christ out of love and service. So too do men and women. The analogy is quite strong on Webb's own definitions. Webb also discusses two concepts related to the trajectory approach specifically. The preliminary movement is when a text pushes cultural boundaries as far as they can helpfully be pushed, such as the softening of the slave-slave-master relationship in the household codes. The idea is that more needs to be done in the cause of justice, but the New Testament only gets the ball rolling. A seed idea is the presence in a text of a signal toward an ultimate ethic, one which moves beyond what is actually in the text generally. While often helpful, Webb's interpretation of the inerrant commands of seed texts is subjective and sometimes fails to capture the heart of the commands. 1 Timothy 2:12 boils down to, "Choose teachers, leaders who are worthy of high honor within the congregation." We have seen weaknesses in several of Webb's criteria. The next chapter unpacks four additional concepts. Chapter 6, Hermeneutical Considerations, Part 2. This chapter deals with hermeneutical principles including the basis in original creation, primogeniture, the relationship between creation and redemption, and the relationship between specific instructions and general principles. We discuss the first here. So far, we have treated arguments based in creation as inherently transcultural or universal. William Webb questions this. He points to 9 patterns rooted in original creation and notes that not all are in fact transcultural. The prohibition against divorce, and therefore the priority of the sanctity of marriage, is transcultural insofar as it represents a higher moral ideal. Webb sees polygamy and Sabbath rules as creation-rooted concepts which fail this test. They bear a significant cultural component. In response, and in addition to applying a more nuanced understanding to polygamy, the Sabbath, and other features, we might say that salvation history is by far the most significant factor in determining how to apply any creation pattern to life today. Furthermore, polygamy, like slavery, was tolerated, not endorsed, and it is undercut in the creation narrative by a one-man, one-woman principle. The patriarch's example does not undermine that foundation. The payoff for the gender debate comes in the form of Webb's suggestion that the relationship between the man and woman in the garden bears both transcultural and culturally bound elements. On the one hand, they are both made in the image of God and so are equal. But on the other hand, the woman is the helpmate. She's made from Adam's rib. Adam names her. And most significantly, the man is created first. The latter set appears to be patriarchal data, cultural artifacts, hanging on the transcultural principle of gender equality for Webb, though he is forced to concede that the order of creation, man, then woman, is strong in the complementarian's favor. Once again, we notice that male headship in the context of gender equality is a creation concept, whereas slavery has no such lineage. Conclusion. In summarizing the major issues of slaves, women, and hermeneutics, we must remember what is at stake. It is imperative to pass on to our children a clear vision of manhood and womanhood. The church cannot grow weary in defending this biblical vision of complementarianism, nor can it compromise and look more like the world. We must grow and flourish in our own gendered personhood to know God's design for human beings made in His image. Copyright 2014, Books at a Glance. Books at a Glance book summaries are available by subscription only, and except for brief quotes, may not be reproduced, in whole or in part, without express written permission.